In this part of Focus 580, we will be looking back to the last presidential campaign. We'll be talking with a journalist who spent a lot of time following the candidates, starting in 1998 and continuing through the aftermath of the election. Our guest is Dana Milbank. He's White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Before that, he worked for the paper's style section and also was a senior editor at The New Republic. He has put out a new book that's based on stories that he wrote all the way along throughout the primaries and then the general election. The title of his book is Smash Mouth, 2 Years in the Gutter with Al Gore and George W. Bush, Notes from the 2000 Campaign Trail. It's published by Basic Books. And if you like politics, I think that you will enjoy the book. It has an irreverent tone, which depending on how you feel about politics, you might either like or you might not. In any case, it's out in bookstores now, and you can check it out. Let me just read you a couple of lines from the introductory section of the book. He writes, "For the purpose of this book is to celebrate the virtues of good, solid, in-the-gutter campaigning. Such nasty, smash-mouth politics are said by the goody-goodies to be destroying our democracy, alienating the electorate, and suppressing voter participation." He goes on to write that he believes the opposite is true. Nasty is nice on the campaign trail. It's cool to be cruel. Contrary to everything you hear and read, presidential campaigns are not getting more negative or nastier. Even if they were, there's evidence that negativity doesn't necessarily hurt turnout or increase cynicism, as the righteous have claimed. There's no reason to believe tough negative campaigning helps. There is reason to believe tough negative campaigning helps strengthen our leaders, boost creativity in policymaking, and bring reform to government. And our guest is joining us by telephone. As we talk, you're welcome to call in. Maybe you have questions and comments of your own. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Mr. Milbank, hello.
Hello.
Thanks for talking with us today.
Happy to.
We appreciate it. And it does certainly seem that you're going contrary here to the conventional wisdom that says all of these things. It says politics is getting more negative. It is bad. It turns people off. It's bad for turnout. First of all, you seem to be saying that, well, you don't really think that those things are true. And in fact, some people who've looked at the issue have concluded that probably that's not true.
Right. I think on all of those points that the conventional wisdom is wrong. You can you can go all the way back to Thomas Jefferson to see nasty, scandal-driven campaign coverage. Abe Lincoln was called an ape by his opponent. And nothing really has changed. The only thing that's changed over the years is the press has started to write about negative campaigning as if it were something bad, instead of just accepting that that's how we govern, so therefore that's how we should campaign in politics. Now, in terms of voter turnout, everybody will cite these polls that say people don't like negative campaigning, but these same polls say 98% of the people are going to vote in a given election, and we know that half of them are apparently lying, or at least saying what they what they think they should say or what the pollster wants to hear. So in reality, there's a reason why we as Americans like football more than we like the ballet. And it's just our nature, and I don't see why we should make politics try to put it on some different plane from everything else.
It seems also to be the case that maybe one of the reasons that reporters spend a lot of time talking about negativity is that candidates more and more seem ready to accuse their opponents of being negative.
Right, and that itself has become sort of a negative attack in politics. Bill Bradley doing this to Al Gore, saying attack, 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 all you do is attack, and you're making all these lies about me. How can America believe you? That itself was quite a negative tactic. I think they know that the candidates know the press's sort of newfound proclivity to treat the negative as bad, and therefore they're going to encourage us to do that. I mean, McCain and Bush were doing this to each other. Bush was doing it to Steve Forbes early on in the campaign. It's just become another weapon they use.
Yeah. And just to take this one step further, I think when you're talking about the issue that it's not such a bad thing for campaigns to be carried out in a tough kind of bare knuckles way. What you're saying is that it's appropriate for candidates to make groundless personal attacks on one another. The point is that there ought to be really aggressive kind of dialogue and debate where somebody says, look, this is what I think. This is what the other person thinks, and really work on pointing out what the differences are between them and their opponent.
Right. I think that the charges that made should be grounded in truth. Now, obviously, you're going to paint your record in the best possible light and the other guy's in the worst possible light, but it has to be grounded in truth. It can't be completely false, and I think it should be relevant. A man's private behavior is relevant if it reflects on his judgment. But if it's completely irrelevant, it's about something someone of his family members has done, I think that doesn't have any place in politics.
Yeah. You in reading the stories that you wrote as you followed candidates along through the primaries and then through the election, one has to wonder, is this really the best way to pick a president? And of course, at least in this particular election, and I'm sure in the past, it's when we've come down to the point where we're getting ready to have the election and the parties have chosen their candidates, often the response of voters is, this is our choice. Mm-hmm. We heard a lot of that from people. And maybe, again, that was a story that the press liked. So we knew that we had a lot of reporters saying, the people are saying, is this our choice?
Right. We did hear a lot of that same complaint again, although this time actually sometime around the convention's polls were done and indicated that people were, in fact, saying that they were pleased with the choices this time, which confounded, I think, many of my colleagues in the press who were ready to write the opposite story. But surely this is, in general, this is no way to pick candidates, based on how much barbecue you can serve at the Ames straw poll, because you recruit a few more hundred people out there, you'll get a nice bump in the media coverage, and suddenly you're going to be out in front of everybody else in the polls. So anytime that a campaign is governed by tonnage of barbecue, I think we've got a little bit of a problem.
Yeah. Our guest in this part of Focus 580, Dana Milbank. He's White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Before that, also worked for The New Republic and spent a lot of time on the campaign trail starting in 1998, following candidates, and he's published a book of his, basically his notes from the campaign trail. Smash Mouth is the title, somewhat adapted from a comment I think that Governor Bush made, where he was characterizing the political rhetoric of the day as being trash mouth. So I think someone suggested to you, well, why not call the book Smash Mouth?
Sure, and as people who are watching the new XFL know, it's an old football and sports term, which has come into vogue, and I think that's appropriate because my whole take is we don't say look, the Ravens won the Super Bowl, but unfortunately they made X number of tackles in the process. I mean, that's part of the game, and there's nothing wrong with it. So I think we as political writers should cover politics in the same way and just accept that them hitting each other is part of the game.
Yeah. I just was interested. I was reading an article the other day about the fact that some of the people who worked in the two campaigns got together for a public sort of deconstruction session, mm-hmm. Talking about what they did and didn't do, and the Democrats, for their parts, talking about what they could have done to get a win, and the Republicans what they could have done for a more decisive win. Mm-hmm. And I was struck here by one of the comments from Carter Eskew, who was a strategist for Mr. Gore, who said that he thought one of the problems was that there was really no plan after the nomination was secured. He said the joke was that everybody was sitting around measuring drapes for the Oval Office as if they just took it for granted. Well, I guess they initially had taken it for granted that he would get the nomination, and then they sort of took for granted that it would be a walk. Do you think that that's true of this campaign?
Well, I actually don't, and I mean, I think it's very fashionable to have second guessing and point, say X, Y, and Z was wrong when a candidate loses. And, and Gore was known for hiring a lot of sort of hired guns who didn't have deep loyalty to him. So it's not particularly surprising that they would come out with all sorts of new theories about various ways in which he and they screwed up. But I think that both candidates ran a solid campaign. It was not like the Dole campaign or the Dukakis campaign, where it's just clearly run very poorly. I think Bush ran a better campaign, but it's hard to find examples of where Gore really did something that he really shouldn't have done. Sure, there were mistakes along the way, and there was the larger question of should he have run more on Clinton's record. But in terms of the tactics and the way they handled the campaign, I don't think anybody's particularly faulting them.
Hmm. Well, I did want to ask about that specifically because it is in the postmortem, that is one of the things that seemed to be said over and over again, that we had this great period of economic prosperity, something that the sitting vice president should have been able to capitalize on, and yet he seemed to have a hard time tying himself to that, and perhaps part of the deal was that he wasn't sure that he wanted really to tie himself to the president. People kept saying, well, Bill Clinton's one of the greatest campaigners ever still, and if he had gone out there on the stump for Mr. Gore, it might have made a difference. Do you, not saying, whether the strategy was right or wrong, but I wonder if as things went along and you saw what the Gore people were doing, and was this indeed something that was talked about when people talked about strategy? Was there debate about, how much do I want to be seen standing next to the president?
Colleagues at the Washington Post just did a terrific story about this screaming match that occurred between Clinton and Gore after the election. Gore blaming Clinton for the loss because of the whole Lewinsky scandal, and Clinton blaming Gore for the loss, saying, look, you didn't have me out there and you didn't run on my record. And I think what was particularly interesting about it is they were both right. The only reason that Gore didn't have an easy walk to victory was because of Clinton's impeachment. On the other hand, Gore was wrong in believing that he could not run on Clinton's record without wrapping himself in Clinton's morality. There was an easier way to make that break, and he just figured it was all or nothing. Those were the two problems here. One conceivably could have been addressed, and the other one was just the campaign turned out. They really had no choice there.
We have a caller to bring into the conversation. Other folks who are listening are welcome to call in if you have a question for our guest, Dana Milbank. And the number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We also have a toll-free line. That's good anywhere that you can hear us. That's 800-222-9455. First caller here is in Champaign and line one. Hello.
Thank you. And I didn't catch the very beginning, so if I'm causing you to repeat yourself, forgive me, and you can be very brief with this part, but a couple of different things. One, given that you don't think negative politics is a reason why voter turnout is so low in the United States, I'd like to know what you think the real causes of low voter turnout are. And then what do you think about if somebody came forward with a dramatically different campaign? And what I guess the point I'm making is that I think one of the reasons why they have to use so much attack of each other is because the differences are so narrow that they have to somehow, make it seem like there's a bigger difference between them. And if somebody came forward with, say, I'll just give some examples. There are probably a lot better ones, but for instance, say that they proposed an increase of $1 a year in the minimum wage for the next 5 years, and then also directly tying congressional salaries to a multiple of the minimum wage, so that the members of Congress would have a direct connection or reason, real visceral reason to care about the people at the bottom of the economic ladder. And possibly putting forth a constitutional amendment that would remove the interpretation of the 14th Amendment that corporations are virtual citizens, and then that gives them so much power over people. And, that sort of thing where you were really putting forth something that would definitely set you apart. And then just you know, taking a positive attitude about it, and then, of course, you would get attacked, and you'd have to respond to those attacks, but it wouldn't be you, you know, needling these small differences.
The small difference argument was particularly made a great deal by Ralph Nader throughout the campaign, and I think the last 2 months should show us that, in fact, this wasn't a campaign, and in fact, it very rarely is a campaign about small differences. When you look at the reversal of overseas abortion rules, when you look at the John Ashcroft, when you look at Gail Norton, and when you look at the tax cut, these are pretty much diametrically opposed to what Gore was talking about. So I think that notion that this is really about small differences is really not true. Now, on the other hand, part of the reason John McCain was such a phenomenon early on in the campaign was because he was taking a different approach and because he was talking about fundamental structural reform in the system. Bill Bradley was doing this to a point, too, but he seemed sort of sanctimonious and above it all. I think the reason McCain was more successful is because he was talking about significant reform, significant differences, and he was also not afraid of engaging in the kind of smash-mouth politics that I was talking about. Now, I'm no political scientist, so I can't speak to the voter turnout question as an expert, but I can just base it on my readings of what the experts are talking about. Actually, voter turnout was up slightly in this election, but it's still around 52%. But I think what we're looking at here is not so much declining number of voters. Indeed, there's more voters. It's we're looking at the numerator instead of the denominator, and what it is a lot more people are registered to vote now because of motor voter. And if you look in a broader trend over time, it's more minorities, more of the poor are registered to vote, and more women are registered to vote. So when it was just the question of white males over 21 who were voting, it was easier to get a higher percentage of that. But and the final point there, I think, is that it's popular. It was for both for a guy like Nader and for a guy like Buchanan to suggest that the low voter turnout reflects disenchantment in the electorate. There's equal reason to believe that it reflects contentment in the electorate and that there is no great crisis, nothing that's particularly dividing us at this time. People feel comfortable with the way things are running, so they don't feel it's particularly necessary for them to get out to the polls.
Well, while I would agree that there are differences between the two major parties, they're not structural differences. I mean, in terms of real structural change, and I think one of the reasons, like somebody like Nader has a problem, and there are a great many reasons, but I mean, there's not the infrastructure there to support that kind of candidacy. There's not the money there to get the message out, and the coverage is very marginal. So I think it's a very complex problem.
Yes, it's sort of a chicken and egg problem.
Well, thank you very much.
All right, thanks for the call. John, I wanted to have you talk a little bit more about John McCain. I think that the perception of the press is that reporters have their agendas and that might lead them to embrace particular candidates, where I think it's more the case that what reporters like is they like a good story, and John McCain certainly was. What happened to John McCain?
Well, I think that the point is, there's always this talk of bias in the media, ideological bias, or particularly a liberal bias in the media. And I think the worship of John McCain and the generally favorable coverage Bush got should put that to rest. The truth is, a politician who was liked by the reporters covering him will get better coverage, and that's exactly what was going on with McCain. He was treating us as people, actually sitting down with us all the time and speaking with us on his bus. His aides were happy to talk. They were plying us with Krispy Kreme donuts and Budweiser beer, and I think that had a lot to do with the McCain phenomenon. He was, started at something like 3% in the polls in New Hampshire and actually won the primary there. Ultimately, he could not overcome Bush's money advantage. He was able to make it nearly even because of the free media that he was able to get. because of the worshipful coverage. But ultimately, it is very hard to trump money in this system, and I think that's what brought him down.
Next caller is in Munster, Indiana, and it's line number 4. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. I wanted to pick up on something that you were just talking about, the reporting. If the reporter likes the candidate, I noticed that I think that there was some very bad reporting going on by Cece Connolly of the Washington Post and a few others that practically 3 weeks before the campaign called Gore a liar and brought up Love Canal and other things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I get a question like that quite a bit, and the difficulty we have as journalists is we're sort of getting it from all sides. We're too tough on Gore, too weak on Gore, too tough on Bush, too weak on Bush, and everybody suspects that we have some sort of other motive going on there. I think, in general, the coverage of Gore was tougher than the coverage of Bush was, and that's, as I said earlier, Bush was a much more likable character who was able to relate to people on a, you know, on a personal basis. So people liked him better. It's, you know, just human instinct. It's no grand conspiracy. And Gore, I often thought it was unfair the way people were piling on about his exaggerations. But the truth is, he is the man responsible for that, because each time what happened is he'd start off with a new exaggeration about, you know, did he travel with so-and-so to Texas for this natural disaster. Just small things, and every time there'd be a new small thing, and everybody would pile on with the previous ones, which you could, you know, hardly blame them for. So there was an easy way for Gore to avoid that, and that was for him to stop doing it, and the fact that he couldn't stop doing it raised questions, I think, even among his supporters.
Mm-hmm. Well, I just thought, though, that it was very unfair, and I think that it was almost like a self-fulfilling prophecy where, you know, I mean, if you keep bringing up like very, very small things, and I think that that trip that Gore took, is that was very minor.
Mm-hmm.
That he...
All of his exaggerations were more minor, whether his dog was paying more money for the prescription, whether, you know, how much work he did on the farm, you know, what his exact role in an inspiring love story was. None of these were grand issues, but taken cumulatively, and Bush was very good at exploiting this, it raised questions about why does he feel the need to provide these slight embellishments everywhere.
But Bush would have been right in taking that on, but I don't think that the press was. I think that the press, they made it into a big story. I think the reporters did, and I think especially Cece Connolly did. I mean, some of the things that they reported were flat wrong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they were wrong, and they might have printed corrections, but I just don't know. I just thought the reporting on Gore was really bad.
I can't agree with you on the particulars. I agree with you in general that the coverage of Bush was more favorable, and, you know, for the reasons that I'd stipulated. But it's important to know that there are people who were just as dissatisfied with the coverage of Bush because we were too tough on him about the drunk driving or about his National Guard record or whatever it was. So we're pretty much going to get it no matter what happens. Which leaves us in a difficult position. The one thing that all the politicians can agree on is that the press messes everything up.
Yeah. Okay, thank you.
Well, thanks for the call. You know, one of the things that you write about in the book, your experiences during the time that you were working for the New Republic, the fact that it was the perception, in Republican circles at least, that the New Republic was a pro-Gore publication. And so when you would ask to have some time with Governor Bush on the campaign trail, as soon as they heard that you were from the New Republic, it was, oh, thanks very much for coming. We'll see you. And that was it. How was there, beyond your experience, do you think, were there big differences in the way that each campaign dealt with the media, particularly in terms of candidate access?
There are, but that was sort of a special case. There had been a history with that magazine and the Bush family Sid Blumenthal had worked at the New Republic and wrote all kinds of really tough stories about the current president's father. So there was sort of a personal animosity there. But in general, I don't think they respond differently to ideological differences in publications. It's more the size of them. And if you work for one of the networks, you're going to get a lot better. You're going to get a lot more access. If you work for a large newspaper, you'll get good access. And it's just based on the number of people you can reach and the way in which they can use you to get their message out.
Yeah. We're a little bit past the midpoint here. Let me just introduce again our guest. We're talking with Dana Milbank. He's a White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Before that, was senior editor at The New Republic and spent a lot of time from 1998 on following candidates on the presidential trail. He's put together a book, a collection of his various stories that he wrote. It's titled Smash Mouth, 2 Years in the Gutter with Al Gore and George W. Bush. It's published by Basic Books. It's out now if you want to look at it. And questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Also toll-free, 800-222-9455. Here's a caller in Champaign County, line number one.
Hi there. Yes. Couple of things. I thought I'd start with just a little thing from Harper's Index. Is that they apparently did a LexisNexis search and they found 360 articles or so of that included George W. Bush and aura of inevitability in them. So maybe they were saying he's not being able to maintain his aura of inevitability or something. But it was an interesting little little index item. What I wanted to go on was. I agree with the earlier caller that regarding corporate and globalization and neoliberal issues, there wasn't that much choice. The unexamined premise that he could have run on Clinton's record has this upper-class bias in it that, you know, if you really examine the demographics of what's happened over the last 30 years, you know, it's gotten better marginally in the last 8 years or so, 10 years maybe, for lower middle class people, but that hasn't even caught up with the loss of the 20 years before that. So, as far as the evidence from the campaign trail is, Gore's best rallies and most enthusiasm was generated, I think, by going back to that old Democrat stance and rallying, you know, working class people. The Madison rally reminds me, but then I guess you will say that's a particular location. But this idea that everything is so wonderful in America, I mean, is a real upper class bias, and it seems that it's being sold back to the people that shouldn't believe it, which is the people that are on the lower end of the range. And not to say that it won't get worse if this tax thing goes through, but I don't know what kind of comments you have on that. But this unexamined premise that, you know, the Clinton record was great to run on because of economics is if you break out the demographics, it's not so good for the people. Granted, they aren't the people that vote the most, but that is a problem.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say you're making a moral argument as opposed to a political strategy argument. So, you know, I wasn't necessarily addressing the correctness of the argument, but the fact is, you know, look at the huge explosion of the economy and the stock market, and these are the people, as you noted, who are voting. So the poor don't vote. That's a problem, but it's not, you know, in terms of when you're plotting strategy, you're not campaigning for the people who are not voting. I mean, this is the larger problem, but you can't blame an individual campaign. You know, if you gear your campaign towards Canadians, you're not going to get any vote. So, you know, I can understand why they pursue things in that way.
Well, in Florida, they actually did have a great get-out-the-vote, and that's why some of the precincts were overtaxed and probably why Chad's piled up and that sort of thing, because they weren't used to that kind of turnout. And I think the strategies to keep down the vote were you know, that still needs to be examined. What kind of strategies, like who did suggest a roadblock here and this and that, you know. That may sound conspiratorial. I think it's really a structural argument.
Yeah.
The easy dichotomy between political and moral arguments is one that I hope resonated with people out there, and I'll I'll just have to hang up and listen to the rest of it.
All right. Well,
it's about across the whole waterfront of American politics, so I don't know, you know, quite what piece of it to respond to there. But you know, I don't think there was sort of the tacit acknowledgement in there that, you know, things have been going poorly for 30 years and they've improved in the last 8 years. And I don't think the caller is suggesting that Clinton and Gore should have been held responsible for the things that happened in the 22 years before they arrived. And the fact is that poverty rates are down and income is up for the poorest. Is it up as much as it is for everybody else? No. But the very interesting thing is that they reversed a very significant trend there. To address sort of the moral side of things, I don't think there would have been anything wrong with making the case that things were better across the board, if not uniformly so. Hmm.
Going back to the period of when we had more candidates rather than fewer, it seems a little bit to me that for you as a journalist covering this, once we lost the candidates who were maybe more colorful but were long shots, kind of the fun went out of the whole thing. Do you think that was true? In losing the candidates that seemed not to be afraid to have a personality that it wasn't quite so interesting?
Well, yes, it's true. I mean, we were blessed this time to have Nader and Buchanan with us till the end, so that added to it. But sure, I mean, you know, when Gary Bauer, you know, is no longer around to fall off the stage, or, you know, you can't chase Lamar Alexander around in his Winnebago across Iowa, or when Orrin Hatch isn't campaigning to win the votes of chiropractors everywhere, if you don't have Donald Trump flying people around on his private 727, it takes something away. But the marvelous thing is, I think there was something like 200 people running for president. Only two of them really had a chance of winning the thing. But there's the Lobster Man running for president on the crustacean liberation ticket. He called me or sent me an email just after the election and claims he got 6 votes in Florida, which, you know, given the way Florida turned out, that wasn't insignificant.
You got to wonder, though, with some of these folks, say, like, take Orrin Hatch, for example. Do you really think that Orrin Hatch really thought that he had some sort of a chance of becoming the Republican nominee?
I don't think Orrin Hatch thought that. I mean, he might have thought, you know, lightning could strike and you never know, so it's better to be in the race. I think what he was doing is saying, look, I'm in my mid-60s. This is the last chance I could really run for president as even a marginally serious candidate. He wanted to be able to say to himself and to his grandkids that, hey, you know, I tried. I ran for the highest office in the land. It didn't win, of course, but he reached as high as he could. And I think that's the same thing that drove Dick Lugar to run. I think it's the same thing that drove Arlen Specter to run. There wasn't a huge downside for him. I mean, I suppose it was a little embarrassing that he couldn't get any votes, but he's back in the Senate and he's a powerful man again, so it's forgotten.
What motivates, do you think, people like Gary Bauer or Alan Keyes or Steve Forbes, for example? Is a lot of that about ego?
It is, in a way. I mean, there are actually 3 different categories there. I mean, Alan Keyes is a commentator who runs for president to boost his visibility, and of course, none of us would know who Alan Keyes is had he not run. In fact, I think he's still running, isn't he? I think he's sort of
he's always running, I think.
Yeah. So, and what's the downside? He gets to holler at the other candidate, he gets to holler at the press, he gets a little bit of coverage. Why not, you know? Gary Bauer, I think, he didn't believe he could win. He believed he could shape the debate more. He miscalculated in a way because he really did not get the backing that he had wanted from religious conservatives who at first rallied quite a bit around Steve Forbes. Now, that's forgotten now because they're so strongly with Bush, but Forbes did quite well with them early on. He just couldn't ignite much anybody else in the electorate. And I think of all of them, he had the most viable chance of actually winning. It seems preposterous now, but in politics, it's all about how much money you have and how much money you can spend. Had there not been as attractive a candidate as Bush, who was able to win over the social conservatives from Forbes, there's no reason why he couldn't have won
the president of one in Iowa or one in New Hampshire, then you'd never know what would happen after that.
People will say that the media somehow embraced Bush or very early on said things like that it was inevitable that he would be the candidate. But it also is the case that quite early on he demonstrated a lot of support among Republicans across the country, and a lot of people early on were willing to give him money, undoubtedly because they thought he had a good shot of being elected. Specifically, though, what do you think what it was about George W. Bush that people were attracted to so early and were willing to endorse him publicly and write checks?
Well, I think the answer may be in the question. I think it was all about money. The caller mentioned earlier, the aura of inevitability is something that he created and extremely successfully. They raised so much money so early on that it just became prohibitive to challenge the man. The press follows the FEC reports and the bank accounts. So this guy is going to get that inevitability coverage. And then guess what? You know, that kind of coverage is out there. The man starts climbing in the polls. So it all becomes self-fulfilling. He started with obviously certain advantages. There was nostalgia because of his father. He had high popularity in Texas. He got all the governors on his side early on. So these all contributed, but the bottom line was just that he was able to get a lot of money very quickly.
Our guest is Dana Milbank. He's White House correspondent for The Washington Post. Before that, he was senior editor at The New Republic. He's the author of a book that brings together his writing about the presidential campaign of 2000. The title of his book is Smash Mouth, and it's published by Basic Books. And questions are welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. We have a caller here with about 10 minutes left. Questions from other folks are certainly welcome. We'll go here to line number 4 in Taylorville. Hello.
Yes, I remember your, I noted your mention about ballet versus football. Well, I know it's absurd and it's slightly highfalutin, but it might be a little nice, and we might have a polywogtics that was slightly less immature, downright adolescent, if we had perhaps 20% of the electorate, which took ballet a mite more seriously. They might take human beings a mite more seriously. They might be less susceptible to this focus group style of determining how to capture voter blocks. I frankly am totally nauseated. We keep talking about the effect of big money, and it's true that both parties are owned by the power elite. They just have a slightly better hold on the Republicans because the Republicans are, well, Republicans. We don't have to go into in-depth definitions. I recall Voltaire's remarking that God's on the side of the biggest armies, and that's a sly way of saying possibly there isn't any God. Well, there's surely a power elite. And years and years ago, a couple of generations at least, in one of Eric Ambler's spy novels, this French fellow says it's a epitaph for a spy, remarks that essentially both parties are working for the same people. Well, that was true then. I think it's even truer now.
Well, Mr. Milbank, you want to comment on anything the caller had to say?
Comparing the normative to what actually exists, and I agree that in an ideal world, people would be as interested in ballet as they would be in football. When we look particularly at politics, there are systems in the world where there isn't a lot of raucous dissent and smash mouth politics, and we can still find that today in Cuba. I think the origin of governing is in opposed ideas that are clashing in the marketplace. It then reaches a
period of compromise or the better idea wins. So it has a Darwinian aspect to it, and I think that that's not only as it is, it's as it should be, because I think that the dissent and the disagreement is healthy to the system, because then you can actually test the ideas in the marketplace.
I'm interested in hearing from you maybe a little bit about what covering the Bush, this Bush White House, is like. It certainly seems as if they are trying to apply some of the techniques that were developed during the Reagan administration for keeping the reporters in line. They said that it was going to be a leak-proof White House. They've got their, I don't know if it's the issue of the day or the issue of the week or,
right,
or whatever it is. What's it like now being a White House correspondent in this White House?
It's changing quickly. It wasn't just Reagan. Clinton did the same thing. And I think most White Houses come in and say, look, it's going to be different this time. We're going to get out the word we want to get out and nothing else. And we're going to, you know, cut off leaks and that sort of thing. It's not going to. It never happens, and it's of course not going to happen this time either. It just takes that period of time till everybody gets to know everybody and settle into a way of doing business. It's not to the Bush White House's advantage to shut off the press, because then they lose the ability to manipulate the press to reward and punish people for the way they're writing. It's inevitable that that will change, and in fact, I think it has begun to change after the first couple of weeks already. So it's not peculiar to them more than to any other White House. They were far more disciplined as a campaign, but the campaigning is in a way is a simpler thing, because it's about arguing, but you don't have to negotiate with the other side. You don't have to. I mean, we're essentially in a power sharing arrangement now with the Congress, and they cannot. They will not have the monopoly over ideas or over the message that they had before.
Well, I suppose that one of the things that one tries to do in a political campaign is have as much control over external events as you possibly can, and of course that's not really possible. But I guess now that being the president, being in the White House, you have even less concern over external events than you did, less control. So who knows what happens from one day to the next.
Particularly since the Senate is evenly split and could very easily in the near future become controlled by the Democrats. And the fact is, the Republicans need 60 votes to pass many of these things, and they only have 50. So he does not have a monopoly on power, and therefore does not have a monopoly on information, and therefore will not be able to function in the way you function during a campaign.
What do people still talk about, or how are people talking these days about Al Gore's political future?
My personal view is that there is no political future for him, but I'm not very good at forecasts. It's hard to tell at this point. I do know that many of his closest aides have no interest in working for him again. They feel that there are a lot of inspiring candidates out there, and he's demonstrated that he's not an inspiring candidate, a good and decent man, but not very good at campaigning. Probably would be very good at governing, but he's doing his teaching now. He's talked about mending fences in Tennessee. He's still living across the river in Arlington, Virginia. It does not look very good for him in the future. My money would be on his daughter, Corinna, to be the next Gore in politics.
We're all people, sometime not very long ago, someone coined the term the permanent campaign to describe the fact that now in politics it seems it just never stops. Certainly the need to raise money never stops. So are indeed people in Washington already looking ahead to the next presidential contest, particularly on the Democratic side? There's a lot of talk about who would be likely candidates and who might get people excited.
Oh, sure. by from your area is often mentioned at the top of the list there. More immediate is the elections in 2 years for the House and the Senate, and the Democrats, if history of any guide, have a strong chance to take over both of those chambers. But the primary campaign exists not just in the money chase or in the electoral chase. It's more a statement of how a White House functions. And you can see now there are certain weeks devoted to the tax cut, to the faith-based initiative, to defense reform. This is very similar to the way a campaign runs. The idea is you get your message out there, you steer public opinion in your favor, and you'll have the advantage when they debate this up on Capitol Hill. It's very much a campaign mindset.
Well, there we'll have to stop because we've come to the end of the time. We want to say, Mr. Milbank, thanks very much for talking with us. Our guest, Dana Milbank, he's White House correspondent for The Washington Post. If you'd like to read his book, again, the title is Smash Mouth, 2 Years in the Gutter with Al Gore and George W. Bush, Notes from the 2000 Campaign Trail. It's published by Basic Books.